Hello, everybody, and welcome to Season 3 of the True Crime Banter Podcast. The podcast aimed at bringing you your dose of murder relaxation. So, just sit back and enjoy. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the True Crime Banter Podcast.
Hello.
We got another case for you guys tonight that I did no research on, but thank goodness I have a wife now because she's doing it all. Mm-hmm. Before we get into the case, I do have a couple shout-outs. Not really shout-outs, but on the last episode, one of the questions that I posted on, or I guess pinned to Spotify, and we discussed it in our bit of banter, was what would your, like, walkout song be?
Right.
And we got a few responses.
Yeah, we did.
So, my sister, Kaylin.
Oh, yeah.
She, on brand with what I said, she said Semi-Charmed Life.
Okay.
By Third Eye, or Semi-Charmed?
Yeah.
How do you say that? I don't know how you say
it. Either way.
One of the way. Anna Viothic said hers would be Fire by 17.
Okay.
And for her funny one, the Muffin Song. I don't know what that song is, but
it
think
sounds
funny.
Amazing.
Yeah, that
I'm
works.
Pretty sure we'd be able to find it pretty quick if we Googled that.
I'm sure. And then Aaron Dean also left his response.
Oh, yeah,
and all he said was war.
Okay.
I get it, too.
All right.
What is it good for?
Yeah, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing.
That's right. Anyways, we got some more banter for you guys today.
Yeah, go for it.
And this was inspired by a video you sent me of the child that you nanny, one of them. You guys discovered something today on adventure.
We were
dropping off
his brother at some little event thing he does, and up in the corner of the parking lot was this little hidden gem that I was like, "What is that?" And we walked over there. I struggle to find things for him to do. I don't want him on his little computer games all day. So we went outside, and there was a little tether ball hiding up in the corner,
yeah,
which I haven't seen in so long. I think Playgrounds banned them or something. I think I remember when I was younger and they had them, there was a real problem with them wrapping around kids'
like necks or
well,
something?
Like
or
the
like
arms
okay.
and the
yeah,
wrists,
yeah.
And it would create like really bad
rug
purple
burns
bruisings
or things
and
like
stuff.
That, or, yeah.
Yeah, and I haven't seen one in, I don't know,
yeah,
really
and
long
you,
time.
You showed me that, and I was like, whoa. Instantly, I was brought back to like elementary school recess.
And he's only like 3.5, so they haven't been around since he's been alive. So he was like amazed.
What is
he was
this?
Like, what is this?
Ball and
ball
a rope.
On a rope, and it just swings around.
So I wanted to ask you, and I told you this was going to be my banter for, for this episode.
And I did not think of an answer, but I'll figure it out.
Do you have any good or bad memories of like the general idea of recess during elementary school?
I remember like I've always been really active. I remember dodgeball was
okay,
really fun when we would do it. But I remember it was the big risk I took when I would play it was that if you miss it and you swing and you kick the air.
Kickball.
Oh, what'd I say?
Okay, dodgeball.
Oh, I'm so
okay,
sorry.
I was
going
to ask you because dodgeball, I'm like, that wasn't really much.
No. Kickball. I'm sorry. And if you swung, you miss it, you were like the fucking idiot.
Yeah, you're like the ball's rolling
you
at you.
Stupid.
You
and I was at the age where I cared what boys thought and I was like humiliated. Oh my God. And
So that was like,
that was
would be
like
a low light.
It was
of like
an anxiety thing where I was like, everyone's playing it, I guess. And I was like, oh, just think about it all day before it came. Everyone would be like, we're going to play kickball. I was like, no. And I think about it at lunch. I'd stress out, like start sweating.
Yeah. I think I'm with you there because my low light of like, the anxiety of recess also centered around like sports because I was very active too.
Yeah.
And it was if you weren't like a captain to pick teams for something.
Oh my God.
Wondering like when you were going to get picked. Like,
oh,
are you going to
be
the last pick?
Yeah.
And you look like the loser.
Right. Then no one wants to be on their
everyone's
team.
Like, when it gets down to you, everyone's like, aw.
I know.
You're like, cool. Thanks, guys.
I'm right here.
Thanks, guys. Not to say I was ever the last pick.
Yeah.
But
totally. Yeah.
Right. What about any good memories?
Well, shit that I was really good at. I loved playing races because I just knew I was going to own everyone.
What is it?
Whatever I was good at. Whatever people were playing that I knew I was good at, I was like,
this is going to be great.
This could be a great day.
I mean, I guess the same thing. Like in sport, it was like, okay, I'm pretty good at this stuff.
Yeah.
Another like low light though, I do remember, and this is actually what made me think of this with the whole tetherball thing, was because I was very short as a child.
Okay.
I think until like my junior year of high school, I was like 5'1". So like a child.
Okay.
And like, anyways, so as a, like a second, third, fourth, fifth grader, I was like 2.5 feet tall.
Are you listening to this as a 5'2" adult?
Right. Well, okay. So, tetherball was one of those things where I was like, we're going to let the tall kids play that game.
Like, I'm too like, tired.
Because
anyway.
They would do that. They just hit it and it just go over your head.
Yeah.
And you're like, I'm trying. And no, if you don't time it right, you're.
Screw it.
What is it? Netball or.
I don't even
hand,
know.
Not handball, but like when the net would hit your. Or the string would hit your wrist.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah. I can't remember.
They're like, that. You can't do that. You're out. You know, well, fuck you guys. Yeah,
fuck you guys. I'm going home.
So anyway, yeah, I don't. Cool. I don't know if I have any.
Well,
really
I'd love
good...
to hear about other people's anxieties on the playground. So
yeah,
feel
do
free
you guys have any good
know.
Memories? I've got some. I'm not. I don't know if I've talked about some of the memories I have from like elementary school recess with anybody. And I'm sure as hell not gonna like talk about it here on a recording for everyone to listen. Maybe we'll talk about it like later on.
Okay.
But,
well, I'm gonna be honest. I'd rather hear about people's like terrible experiences on the playground.
Okay.
All right. So if you guys have anything, I'd love to hear it. Yeah, or embarrassing, or maybe you had a friend who something embarrassing happened to. I love that stuff.
Yeah. Oh gosh. Yeah. There's a lot of things that could happen on the recess.
Yeah. Feel free, guys.
On
right
the,
in
the pavement. Remember, no running on the pavement.
Yeah, I still say that to the kid. I mean, all the time. A mother heads home after her late night shift, but with a close-knit group of friends and family, her absence is quickly noticed, and the next morning, a huge search ensues. When her car is found abandoned, it leads to a treasure trove of clues telling police this was no disappearing act. Was she nearby and injured? Had she hitched a ride and left her life behind? In a matter of weeks, the story came together. This is the case of Lori Bray.
Fifty-seven-year-old Lori Bray was loved by so many. She was one of those great rare breeds of people who would literally give the shirt off of her back if you needed it. Not only was she a great friend, but a great mom. Her grown son Justin and her were very close, speaking on the phone every single day. When she wasn't at work or with Justin, she was fostering dogs or donating her time to animal shelters. Animals, but especially dogs, held a very big place in her heart. After her shifts at the local casino, she couldn't wait to get home to her own two dogs, whom, of course, she was obsessed with. This is exactly what I'm sure she was thinking when she closed up for the night on September 30th, 2019. She lived in Laurel, Montana, a very small town where everyone knew each other. So she said goodnight to her friends and coworkers and headed home to sleep, since she also had the opening shift the next day. But this would be no ordinary drive home. Kathy, Lori's boss and close friend, also had the opening shift that next morning on October 1st. And as she drove the long, desolate back road to work, she saw a car up ahead, parked at an intersection. She could tell from a distance something was weird, because the car was in the road, but also pulled off to the side. As she got closer and slowed down, she noticed this car looked exactly like her friend Lori's car. Back at the casino, coworkers quickly noticed Lori hadn't shown up for her morning shift, which was very unlike her. She was someone who would call in if she didn't feel well, or at least give a heads up if she was running late. Kathy had a terrible feeling, and she called Justin, Lori's son, to see if he had heard or seen his mom that morning. What Kathy didn't know was that Justin was way ahead of her. Him and his mom spoke every single morning, and when she missed his call, he started having a really, really bad feeling. When Kathy called, this was enough for him, and he sped over to his mom's house, but what he found was nothing of comfort. He let himself in only to find the dogs without food, without water, which Lori would never do. These dogs were her babies, and she would take care of them before she would take care of her own self. Looking around, it looked clean and put together, but this was alarming for Justin. It didn't even look like she had come home the previous evening. Her bed was all tucked in, no dishes in the sink as if she hadn't had any breakfast, and no signs of her getting ready that morning for work. So Justin fed the dogs and called Kathy back, telling her he'd meet her at Lori's car. Once he pulled up, Justin immediately knew it was his mom's car. And this was not good at all. There was no reason for her car to be here, on this road, nowhere close to her home, and parked this way with her nowhere in sight. As they opened up the doors, it just got worse. On the back seat were Lori's clothes, underwear, pants, and small signs of blood. Not only that, but her purse and phone were on the back seat floor. They didn't want to risk contaminating the car of any evidence, so with that, they called the police. Once on scene, it wasn't looking good to them either. They found all the same alarming signs that Justin and Kathy did, along with a muddy shoe print on the passenger's side door. Examining the clothes they found, they saw tears and rips, as if the clothes had been violently torn off of her. This was more than enough for police, and a search team was immediately put together for the surrounding areas. At this point, they had no idea what type of situation they were looking at, but with bloodstains covering more than half the back seat, it couldn't have been good. Either way, they find her harmed somewhere nearby, or worse.
Many people knew and loved Lori in this small town, so it didn't take long for hundreds of missing posters and social media posts to be circulated in hopes that someone knew where she was or came forth with something helpful. Teams of people searched for hours until it had to be called off due to nightfall. Reluctant searchers headed home and waited for the daybreak to head back out again. As you know, when an investigation begins, people are assigned to gather all types of information, whether that's interviewing close friends and family, tracking electronic data, or tracing the victim's last movements. In this case, video footage would be the jackpot that got this case moving. Kathy not only got them all the footage they needed from the casino's previous evening, but being a longtime employee, she was able to identify many of the people on the tape and even give them some of their details. This was a huge asset to police, who usually have to find this all out on their own. They didn't see much on tape from Lori, nobody following her, acting strange or anything, but a little bit before her shift ended, she was seen cleaning machines, and not too far away was a man wearing a sweatshirt with the hood pulled up. You wouldn't even have noticed him. He was playing on his phone, minding his own business. Lori exits the frame, speaks to a couple women, says goodbye to them, and then that same sweatshirt guy is seen approaching Lori as she cleans behind the bar. Turns out that he knew those two women that she was just speaking to. You see Lori check his ID, make him a drink, and continue closing duties. A few minutes later, you see her now on the other side of the bar. You can't hear anything she's saying, but you can see her point to the clock behind him, most likely telling him that they're about to close and that he needs to leave. He exits. You see her exit the frame again, grab her stuff. She reappears with her jacket and purse and heads out the locked door to her car right in the frame of the exit camera. Right as she's about to get into her car, you see her walk back towards the door, but off to the side, as if she saw something or someone. Moments later, a figure appears from the corner and walks with Lori to her car, hopping in the passenger side. It was clear to see on camera it was a hooded male figure. Kathy quickly confirmed the young man to be 22-year-old Diego Hernandez. Police had no idea if Diego was linked to Lori's disappearance, but according to them, he was most likely the last person to see Lori that evening.
Thankfully, Diego was easy to find. He was found hanging out at his house that morning, and police took him down to the station for a recorded interview, but the story he gave wasn't anything groundbreaking. According to him, he had gone to the casino that night on a whim. He had a hookup there and got free drinks, so he hung out for a little, played a couple machines, drank a little, and left. He said he and Lori got to talking, and she offered him a ride. He said the last time he saw her, she was driving off after dropping him at his house. As police listened and took notes, they couldn't help but notice Diego's face. It was covered in really deep red scratch marks. When asked to remove his sweatshirt, they found more on his body and hands. But Diego had a simple explanation. Him and his friend Nick had been hanging out a couple nights ago at a strip club. Some words got exchanged, and they got into a little scuffle. Nick had been wearing a ring, so when they fought, obviously it scratched his face. Well, police weren't going to just take his word for it, so luckily enough, they followed up with Nick. And surprisingly, Nick confirmed that yes, they did hang out a few nights ago, but they had been driving around when Diego started acting a little crazy. Nick had pulled over, got him into a headlock, and kicked him out of his car. When they showed Nick the photo of Diego's face, he was fairly confused. There's no way he could have given Diego those injuries from a simple headlock. Doing the extra work, police tracked Diego's movements from before the casino, finding footage of him at a local bar earlier in the evening. On camera, clear as day, you can see his face, and you can see his face very scratch-free. Even though Diego had been caught in a lie, the evidence was just still not enough, and at this point, he was their only suspect. But a suspect in what? Lori hadn't even been found. Not yet, at least. Then came the next morning on October 2nd, when a young man was riding his ATV in a remote wooded area and up ahead saw a woman's naked body on the ground. He didn't get very close, but he didn't have to see how badly beaten she was and how obviously deceased she had been. The cops were called, and while they couldn't confirm it right away, them and the public had an awful feeling that it was Lori. And a couple days later, it was sadly confirmed that it indeed was 57-year-old Lori Bray. This missing persons case was now officially a homicide investigation. As Lori's family, friends, and the public began the grieving process, police were getting back the autopsy, and the findings were brutal. Lori had been savagely beaten almost everywhere, but especially in her face. Her eyes were found swollen shut. While the official cause of death was strangulation, they found broken ribs and severe head trauma as well. It seemed sexually driven, so they did tests, but nothing came back at the time of the autopsy, so it couldn't be ruled out yet. Based off the surroundings, police surmise she was killed in her car, then transported to the spot that she was found in.
Police still had Diego in mind as their lead suspect, but they couldn't rule anyone out, especially after close friends mentioned that Lori had a couple violent exes in her past. But for one reason or another, they were ruled out, leaving only Diego. As investigators were getting as much evidence together as they could to bring forth charges, the community held a candlelight vigil for Lori in her favorite park where she walked her dogs every day. As hundreds of people showed up, it was apparent to everyone the reach that she had on the community. Friends shared stories of Lori and people cried together while remembering her caring spirit. But all the while, they couldn't shake the eerie feeling that this once safe town was no longer the secure place they thought it was. Lori's killer could be anywhere, and the shift was obvious to everyone. Laurel had been changed. Family of Lori started a GoFundMe, raising money to care for her dogs, help support Justin, and cover funeral costs. The city of Laurel was showing up in every way they could. Back at the station, the timeline of Lori's evening was coming together, and it was telling quite the story. Her phone's GPS was pinging at several locations between the hours of 12 and 3 a.m., including the casino, where she worked, where her body was eventually found, and a location very close to Diego's house. But according to the coroner, she would have already been dead at this point. They also visited the bar that Diego stopped at before the casino that evening, the one that they pulled the security footage from to see his face for the scratches. The stories they heard were disturbing and very familiar. According to the bartender and a couple female customers, Diego had been a busy boy that night, talking to multiple women, pressuring each of them for rides home that evening, even the female bartender. She said he was making a lot of the female customers very uncomfortable and not taking no for an answer.
Working closely with the DA, they finally had enough on Diego, and on October 4th, they executed a search warrant for his home. When they went to find the clothes he was wearing that evening Lori was with him, they found the items soaking wet after being washed recently, and his pants were coated in bleach stains. Now, clean clothes wouldn't be that big of a deal if the rest of his home wasn't a total shithole and covered in piles and piles of dirty clothes, except for the items from that evening. Definitely not suspicious at all. On top of that, a pair of shoes with the same tread marks as the kind found in Lori's car and near her body were found soaking wet and also recently scrubbed clean. After getting a hold of his electronics, police found searches such as, how long do investigations last? Hey Siri, how long do FBI investigations last? Is there a limit to how many years they can investigate someone? As the search of his home continued, he was at the station giving a DNA swab and telling a new story about Lori. This time, Lori had given him a ride, and at one point they pulled over, and he made sure to point this out. They had consensual sex, I'm air quoting if people can't see because they can't, after smoking a ton of cigarettes in her car, but he was adamant after that he didn't see her at all. When the DNA came back and showed a match to the DNA found all over her body and under her fingernails, they pulled the trigger and Diego was arrested. Surprise, surprise, he changed his story again. This time, he claims he had been in a secret relationship with Lori for over a year, and she didn't want anyone to know about it, so he couldn't tell the cops the truth all these other times. By this point, as you can guess, cops, they weren't believing anything Diego was saying. They went back into both Diego and Lori's phones and devices, even going back further than a year, and weren't able to find a single contact shared. No texts, no calls, not even a mutual interaction. This was a clear last-ditch attempt to establish some sort of relationship or reason for Diego's DNA to be all over Lori.
2 days after his arrest, Diego was officially charged with one count of deliberate homicide. This came as a complete shock to those who knew him. He was well-known and well-liked. But as we all know, that doesn't mean anything. Humans are capable of some really fucked up shit. When the trial started, prosecutors laid out a story they think is the closest to what actually happened. They said that most likely, Lori and Diego had struck up a conversation at the casino, and when she left and saw him outside, she felt bad for him. Being the kind-hearted person she was, she wanted to give him a ride home. Most likely, at some point, Diego tried to make a move, she freaked out, he got upset, and ended up beating her. They believe his story about them having consensual sex before, stating they were in a secret relationship, was a way for Diego to show that there would be a reason for his DNA to be on her and or inside of her. The defense came back with anything they could, saying that they couldn't trust any evidence found in Lori's car because it was left unsupervised for so long before cops processed it, so who knew if it had been contaminated. Now, I don't know if you all know what methadone is because I didn't, so I had to look it up. It's categorized as an opioid and narcotic, but it's also sort of odd because it's used to help lessen painful symptoms from opiate withdrawals and blocks the euphoric effects of drugs like heroin, morphine, and codeine. But it's also a Schedule II category for substances, which includes like cocaine and methamphetamine. So it's really weird because it's like also a drug, but it's also helped to treat drug use and drug addiction.
Right, so it could be viewed as both good and bad.
Right, I so guess. I'm still, you know, there's going to be nurses or doctors or whatever that are like, actually it's this or whatever, but that's the clearest way I can describe it on there. So it's kind of a sketchy thing because it can be used to help, but it's also like at a really high risk for being addicted to if you kind of start the treatment. So it's supposed to be prescribed by a doctor and like monitored your usage and stuff.
Okay.
So the reason I'm telling you all this is because in Lori's toxicology, methadone was found. So the defense decided to try and use this. They said that because none of her friends and family knew that she was using this, which they didn't, they tried to equate it that like, if she was hiding this, she could have been hiding a secret relationship with Diego and not telling anybody.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, exactly. And this was just a really sad and poor attempt on the defense's side. The DNA timeline and overall evidence against Diego was overwhelming, to say the least. The prosecution's job came easy, and luckily the jury had no problem seeing through the defense. The jury sat through hours and hours of testimony, looking through evidence, and even traveled to the site that Lori was found at. Once back in the deliberation room, it only took them 2 hours to find Diego guilty. Right as Diego was going to be sentenced, he asked to speak, and in a shocking, last-minute move, he pled guilty, saying, "I did it. I killed her." After a year of proclaiming his innocence and swearing that Lori and him were secretly dating, he had finally told the truth. Many people think that he did this last minute to get some sort of leniency from the judge, but thankfully that didn't happen, and he was swiftly sentenced to life in prison.
Okay, I mean, good.
Yeah.
I would say. I'm shocked. This is one of those situations where people are just... It makes you wonder why they think they'll get away with it.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot you can make an argument for. Not really, but anything after the fact of what happened after him and Lori left.
Yeah.
No one really knows, right?
Right.
Even if there was, like, some secret relationship, that would explain his DNA there. But it's kind of, in my opinion, the damning evidence is the video footage of him before ever even interacting with Lori.
Yeah.
And his whole excuse of, you know, I had these scratches on my face from days prior, that's out the window. And immediately you're a liar.
Yeah.
And also, we kind of discussed this before recording. Sometimes you can't always be the nice person.
Right.
In the sense of, you gotta, other podcasts, they've got like,
Are you talking about Crime Junkie?
What is it?
Where they
what
say,
stay weird. No, they say, stay weird, Portland.
No, they say, be weird, be rude, stay alive.
Ah, yeah. And that's kind of one of those things where it's like, especially as like, you definitely know it more than me, being a woman, it's like, there's so many easy ways to be taken advantage of.
Yeah.
Just physically that like.
Yeah. We're talking about physically too. And yeah. It's one of those terrible things where we have to, I'm not talking about females, but just in general, like nice people, you have to adjust yourself for the world. The world isn't going to adjust itself for you. So you can be this super sweet person, but you kind of have to almost adapt this personality where you just question everything because you have to, because otherwise, you know, you're going to end up eventually in the bad company, you know, people who are going to take advantage of you.
It makes you think of like when 9/11 happened, where it was kind of like the see something, say something type thing, where like, in a sense of like, you almost have to be on guard now. And there wasn't like, it wasn't like there was this big shift in America that like, oh, you know, people should be on guard for other pieces of shit people. In a sense of like walking your car, or giving someone a ride home. But it seems like over like the last 20 or 30 years, people are more aware that like, even the people that you think are good people could very easily be pieces of shits.
Yeah.
And it kind of sucks.
No, it definitely sucks.
You can't just trust someone and be a nice person. And like, just live your life as a nice person.
Yeah, I know.
Well, speaking of nice people, you're one of them for doing the research on this. You like that?
I have a little bit more free time than you, so I might as well. But you know what? Now that we're kind of a little bit back in it, it's like doesn't feel like such a chore, so I'm excited. I'm already like, I think I told you 25% of the way done with the next one. So hopefully in the next couple of days we can be sitting here again recording another for you guys. That'd be awesome.
Yeah. I'm going to leave that question up about your guys' favorite or like best/worst/embarrassing recess moments of elementary school. Send
it in, guys. I'll read some of the good ones on the next one.
Ooh, yeah. Yeah, I'll let you read them next time.
Thanks.
I'm not very good at that.
That's okay.
I hope you guys enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening, everyone. And here we are again. Hopefully we can keep this train rolling now that we've started again.
Here we go.
Chugga, chugga, choo, choo.
All right. That has been another episode of the True Crime Banter Podcast, and we'll talk to you guys next time.
Bye.
Adios.